I sincerely thank you for wanting to come and learn more about some fascinating, exciting, engaging, fulfilling, and little-known subject of women, about determined women who served in uniform and many in harm's way when society said they weren't equal with men. They received less pay, less recognition, and weren't allowed to vote in federal elections. To give you an idea of America's interests, I found that authors have published around 350 books on Custer at the Little Bighorn. But good luck finding 10, 12, 15 books on women who served in uniform in World War I and went into harm's way. But with a little bit of luck and a whole lot of work, there's now about 16 books on women veterans of World War I from Montana. I'm extremely fortunate to have Diane Carlson Evans write the foreword to my book. A remarkable woman in her own right, she was a nurse, a combat nurse in the Republic of Vietnam during the Vietnam War. She led the effort to get the Women's Vietnam Memorial in Washington, D.C. that cost her 10 years of her professional life. And I'm very honored to have her write the foreword to my book. She lives in Helena. Some topics I'll be looking at are shown here, some background for you to set the stage. I'll be looking at where the women served, when they served, how they went into the military, when they served in battle, and I'll do a summary. I'm asked many times, what got me going on this? And what got me started? It wasn't an assignment. No publisher said, Ed, we need a subject for a new book. About a whole lot of years ago, I was decorating graves in a Billings cemetery. And I ran across the grave of Florence Ames. She's buried on a small hill in the eastern part of the cemetery. I looked at her gravestone and it captivated me then and it still does. I looked at it and as you'll see at the very bottom of it, someone engraved the lyrics to the bugle tune Taps on her headstone. And I said, Florence Ames, Montana, nurse, Army Nurse Corps, World War I. Who is this woman? What is her service? And why is she buried by herself? And as an experienced genealogist, I began to look into Florence, her history, and the project began. I said, if there's Florence, and then there's many more. And that began an eight-year journey for me to find these women in Montana, find out what they did, and record their story. What I found is a good quote from Eleanor Roosevelt, one of my favorite women of all times. And as you can see this, she's pretty capable. And when she said, women are tough, we don't give them enough credit for what they do. My research has found about a little over 200 women entered the military service from Montana. I had to put some caveats on the number there. Regardless of where they were born, where they lived, or where they died, all of the women I found entered the service from Montana. A little over 200. What did they do? Most of them were in the Army Nurse Corps. They came from all over the state. They came from 28 states, 8 countries, and 1 United States territory, and 50 of these women were actually daughters of Montana. They were born here. None were killed in action. No American female in the military in World War I was killed in action by a hostile fire, but around 266 did die of disease, exhaustion, and over half of those deaths occurred right here in the United States. A little bit of background here. It wasn't called World War I, was it? It was called the Great War, or the War to End All Wars. It began in Europe in August of 1914, and America said, no, we're not having anything to do with this. Europeans are perpetually squabbling people. They just can't get along, and let's stay out of this. But the war began to escalate, and many people in America in political power said, we need to start getting ready for this because we're going to get drawn into it. And that was called the Preparedness Movement of 1916. This included increasing the American Red Cross because by law, the American Red Cross nurses were the Army's battle reserve for nurses. And that was codified in federal law. And the Red Cross began to get ready for an eventual war they saw coming. And in April of 1917, the war began. When the war began, America's Navy sailed. The Secretary of the Navy of that time, with the biblical name of Josephus Daniels, he was a progressive Democrat, a newspaper man from North Carolina. And his wife, Mrs. Josephus Daniels, was a bit of a suffragette in her own right, and she's a very capable woman. Daniels said, I need people to take over when the sailors go to sea. I still need people back in the United States to take care of the admin that the Navy does. He did not have enough men. And he said, how can I get women into the Navy? There's a loophole in the Naval Act of 1916 when it said the Navy can enlist people in the Naval Coastal Defense Reserve Force. Now, last time I checked, women are people. And that's what Daniel said. So he said, bring women into the Navy, and I'm going to put them at work. When that order came out, about 11,000 women joined the Navy as female yeomen. A yeoman is a clerk typist. They take dictation, they do filing, and that sort of thing. And when the word got to Montana that the Navy was hiring, about 20 women stampeded the federal office in Butte, trying to find the office where they could sign up. And that began a pretty remarkable piece of Montana history about the women. 17 of Montana's women joined the Navy in World War I as yeomen. By date of entry into the armed forces, Irma Myrtle Wright from Denton, Montana, west of Lewistown, is the first female veteran of Montana who was not a nurse. The other two of distinction were Montana's Gertrude Zur and Helen Sherry. Those two women achieved the highest enlisted rank available to any woman or any woman in World War II American Armed Forces of that day, that of Chief Yeoman. Alice Zur, or Gertrude Zur, was a remarkable woman in her own right. She was a noted author for Harper's Magazine, and she came to Montana because she wanted to write about Montana's people. Her series called Trails in Tiny Towns was published in Harper's Weekly in the early 20th century. She also lived in Billings and wrote about life on the bench. She had a degree from mathematics from the University of Montana, and she taught high school. When the war came, she said, I'm going to do my part, and she enlisted in the Navy and served in Seattle. After the war, she came back to Montana and taught high school in Chinook for 14 years. Never married, no children, and she died there. And last year, my wife and I went to her grave and paid our respects. To get into the Navy, the requirements weren't all that strict. All you had to do was be of good character and be able to type and take dictation. The Navy was enlisting, and because the Navy was subordinate to, or the Marine Corps was subordinate to the Navy at that time, the Navy said, Marines, you're going to enlist women too. The Marines didn't like that idea. But since they were subordinate to Josephus Daniels, they had to do it. Only 300 women were enlisted in the Marine Corps during World War I, and none came from Montana. The Navy women were called yeomanettes. That came from the notion that the Navy had to put some kind of identifier on their rank to ensure everyone knew they were female. If you said that fast enough, yeoman F, it sounds like yeoman et. And that word became a badge of honor to these women. And when the Marine women entered the service, the Commandant of the Marine Corps said, no way are we going to call them Marine ets. So they were called women Marines. When the word went out that women were entering the Navy in Montana, The Great Falls Tribune in 1918 ran a note about Alice Johnson from Montana who joined the Navy. The article read, "Miss Alice Johnson has joined the Navy. This does not mean that she will scale the ropes like a real, honest-to-goodness sailor, but she is a yeoman, or rather a yeomanette just the same. Her duties will be clerical in the Bremerton Naval Yard, taking the places of men who are needed to man the guns of the fleet. When told of the possibility to go to France and serve in the American Naval Yards overseas, Miss Johnson gasped a second and exclaimed, 'Oh, wouldn't that be the most wonderful thing in the world?'" A bit of youthful naivete there. When the Army goes to war, they need medical help, doctors and nurses. The Nurse Corps of the United States military evolved slowly. Nurses have been in the military since the Revolutionary War, but that word nurse is subject to definition. During the American Civil War, even President Lincoln wasn't enthusiastic about women supporting the Army in the Civil War. In 1901, the Army Nurse Corps was founded, but it didn't have a nursing school until 1918. The Red Cross was the Army's official nursing reserve. At the beginning of World War I, the Army had 400 nurses and only half were on active duty. At that time, Montana had more registered nurses than the entire United States Army. And in May of 1917, immediately after the War for America began, a delegation from France and Britain came to America and they needed help. They said, "We don't want guns and bullets and bombs. We need doctors and we need nurses." At that time, some innovative men decided that they would create what were known as base hospitals. These were pre-configured hospitals, ready to go, all packed up. All they needed were the people and perishable supplies. One of these hospitals was Base Hospital 10 in Philadelphia. A member of that base hospital was Alice Ralston. She was born in the Big Hole region south of Butte to a very affluent ranching family. They sent her to Philadelphia, where she was trained a nurse. She joined the Navy Nurse Corps in 1914, and because of that, Alice Ralston is Montana's first official military female veteran of any service. When her parents were unfortunately killed in an accident in 1917, Alice came back to Montana, and she worked the family ranch for a while. The war came, and she entered the Army Nurse Corps. Since she was a member of Base Hospital 10, that hospital was one of the first five to deploy to the front lines. Alice went from Montana to the front battle lines in a matter of about 40 days. She served almost two consecutive years on the very front battle line facing the German onslaught, supporting the British forces. Her hospital was one of the highest decorated United States military hospitals ever in war. By the way, after the war, Alice came back to Montana. She never married and never had any children. She died here in Bozeman in 1967, and she is buried in Anaconda. The call to join went out across America to join the Red Cross. The women who became nurses in the Red Cross, I called them triple volunteers. First, they had to enter the Red Cross. Then they had to volunteer to enter the military. And then they had to volunteer to go overseas. They weren't required to go overseas. But what is remarkable about the Montana women is almost half of all of the 200-some women who entered the service volunteered to go overseas. This is one of the highest percentages in America of any state. The Army estimated it would need between 30,000 and 50,000 nurses. Again, they were all volunteers. None of them were drafted. They had to be between the ages of 25 and 35, be graduates of a two-year nursing program. They had to be single. They could be divorced or widowed, but with no children. They also had to be Caucasian. Black nurses, well, separate but equal. A true story came when the American recruits were at Camp Dodge, Iowa, including black soldiers. The black soldiers got sick. When you get 30,000 men together, they're going to get sick, some of them. And a group of volunteer black nurses from Chicago said, we are going to help them. And on their own, came from Chicago to Camp Dodge, Iowa, which is outside of Des Moines, and helped the black soldiers. And the story of the black nurses is little known in America. Also, if you were born in Germany or had a German-sounding name, don't bother to apply. The pay was $50 to $60 a month, and if you went overseas to face bullets and bombs, you got an extra $10 a month. Why did they serve? What makes people do this? Especially when you're entering the service, when you aren't even allowed to vote for those sending you there. Women weren't allowed to vote in federal elections until 1918. I looked at a lot of the very few letters and diaries remaining. I looked at, did they look at altruism, boredom, adventure? Virginia Flanagan from Great Falls wrote simply, it was the right thing to do. There wasn't enough nurses at any time in World War I for the American Army. They needed well over 20,000. They would get half of that. When the women in Montana decided to volunteer, they didn't go as a complete unit. They went as individuals, one of whom was Lucy Walters, a remarkable woman. She was born 60 miles north of the Mexican border, and she was working 60 miles south of the Canadian border when war came. She decided that she would volunteer to go, and in November of 1917, she got her orders to go. She went down to the Glasgow train station by herself. She had a first-class train ticket, 100 pounds worth of luggage, and she was there all alone. The departure ceremony for the men was going to begin in an hour. The men were going to receive patriotic speeches, bands, free lunches, marching parades to the train station, but Lucy went alone and by herself. When she went to Camp Lewis, Washington, outside of Olympia, by the way, there were supposed to be 200 nurses there. She found there was only 30. She wrote back a letter to her colleagues in Glasgow, and at the end of that letter, there is a veiled plea for help. And throughout the war, this is what Lucy Walters did. She went, she served stateside and went overseas, and she had a remarkable career. She came back to Montana. She started a hospital in Glasgow, moved around a little bit, never married, no children, and she died of old age and is buried in California. When these women went to war, well, when the men went to war, they got front page photographs, accolades, all sorts of things. But when the women went to war, they went by themselves. And they didn't get the notice on the front page. When I was researching the women, I found that I had to look in the society column. When a female from Montana went to war and possibly faced bullets, she was at least mentioned right above Dr. Phoebe Bothorf hosting the musical club on Tuesday afternoon. Think about that. You're going to war and facing death, and that notice is in the Women's Society column. Virginia Flanagan is also a remarkable woman from Great Falls. She was one of the first from Montana to join the Army Nurse Corps in June of 1917. And I think she falsified her age to join. She's from Great Falls and a very capable woman, a very capable nurse. The requirements to join the Nurse Corps at that time were between the ages of 25 and 35. And on her official paperwork to get into the Army, she said she was 35. Okay, she made it. But 10 years later in my research, she applied for a U.S. Government passport, and guess what? Her birth date was changed to 10 years before. So I think she lied about her age to get into the Army Nurse Corps. If she did, I don't know. She took that to her grave. She never married, had no children, and she's buried in Great Falls. But she served in Army hospitals in California and in France, and one Red Cross hospital in France. Women went singularly. They didn't go as a unit. But Jane Delano, the chief nurse of the Red Cross, said, I want to start training units and keeping these women together. There is a support and cohesion. And three training units for nurses were established in Montana. One of those was the Columbus Unit 511 from the Columbus Hospital in Great Falls. The Columbus Unit 511 was composed of six remarkable women. Folks, let me tell you something. If you wanted to get around the red-hatted Yah-Ya sisterhood, you got to be around the Great Falls Six. These women went to nursing school together, they graduated together, they wanted to go to war together, and they wanted to serve together. One of the women, Lydia Fausick, right here, her dad was the mayor of Great Falls, A.J. Fausick. And when the Fausick family gave these women a departure luncheon, A.J. Fausick, by the way, he was a cigar maker. He passed out cigar favors to everyone. And I can see these women on the back porch smoking a stogie. The Great Falls Six wanted to go to France. And they were sent first to the East Coast thinking they were going to France. And the Army turned them around and said, we made a mistake. And they turned around and sent them to Camp Dodge, Iowa, which is outside of Des Moines. So think of this. If you thought you were going to Paris, the land of lights, the land of romance, even though there was a war going on, and they turn around and send you to Des Moines, Iowa, well, there it is sometime. But the danger there was when you get 30 to 35,000 men together, disease runs rampant, especially during the great flu epidemic of 1918. This is to give you an idea of what the nurses faced at a similar hospital at Fort Riley, Kansas. These were the hospital conditions they had to serve in. Lydia Fausick got terribly sick and she almost died at Camp Dodge. None of those women were sent overseas. The Army said first that the women had to serve 6 months stateside, and then if they showed the necessary mettle to go into combat, then the Army would send them, only if they volunteered. One of the Great Falls Six is a remarkable woman I doubt any of you know about, Captain Mina Ossin. Mina was one of only three women veterans of World War I from Montana to make the Army a career. She was born in Minnesota, grew up in Minot, North Dakota, and became a nurse in Great Falls. She served in World War I, never went overseas, not by her choice, but she stayed in the Army. She went to China, came back to America, then went to the Philippines and came back. And then about later on in her career, she decided to go back to the Philippines. And she asked for a transfer where she reported to another Montana nurse, Elizabeth Messner, from Lewistown. Mina reported to the Sternberg Army Hospital in Manila, the Philippines, in October of 1941. And I think you know what was coming. You see, what was remarkable about Captain Ossin, she was an angel of Bataan. One of the 66 U.S. Army nurses captured by the Japanese when they invaded the Philippines. Captain Ossin served in Bataan Peninsula, and they escaped to Corregidor. And then the Japanese overran Corregidor and the American Army there surrendered. She was held prisoner of war at Santo Tomas Prisoner of War Camp in Manila for the rest of the war. Not only did she serve in World War I with distinction, but she served in World War II as one of these indomitable women, the Angels of Bataan. And I doubt you knew that. I didn't know that. Sadly, when she died in Minot, North Dakota, when she returned there as an elderly woman to live near family, she died in April of 74. And the day she was buried, a late winter storm struck Minot, and Mina never received the military honors at her burial that she earned. The Great Flu epidemic came in 1918. If you're a nurse and the war was on and you're here in Bozeman, your choices are go help the wounded in France or stay here and help those who are dying around you. What do you do? Did you go overseas and help the war effort? Or as your family and friends are dying in front of your eyes, do you stay here in Bozeman or any other place in Montana? What happened was the dreaded word slacker nurse came in, meaning if you're not supporting the war effort, you better be supporting the public health effort. Criticism came for the nurses who were private nurses. Wage and price controls came in, and it was a terrible dilemma for those skilled in the nursing. Because of that, the federal government started what is known as a student nurse corps. They said, we want a pool of women who are trained at government expense to become nurses and who agree to serve as nurses for at least 3 years. And a student nurse program began. Montana has a distinction of always fulfilling its quota for student nurses. One of the nurses was Agnes Talcott from Billings. She started her nursing training in Billings and was finishing up right here in Bozeman. But unfortunately, she caught the flu and died, and she is buried in Billings. The nurses were not required to go overseas. They volunteered to go. And almost half of Montana's Army nurses volunteered for war zone duty. To get overseas, the word going across was in their lexicon. You always heard that or always read it. It said, when are you going across? That meant, when are you going on a ship and leaving for France? All of the Army nurses and some of the Navy nurses going overseas were staged in New York City. And last year in a presentation, I was asked by a member of the audience, why didn't the Army fly the nurses from New York to Paris? I wasn't quite sure how to answer that, but I said, well, ships might be a better way to do it 100 years ago. When they went to New York City, they went by train. They were given a first-class Pullman car ticket, 100 pounds of baggage allowance, and $4.50 per day per diem. And they stayed in hotels in New York City, where they were issued uniforms and they were given basic training. Virginia Flanagan from Great Falls wrote, it was a strange feeling knowing that at last we were chosen to go to war, and we had waited so long, and we were a very solemn and subdued group of girls as we descended the stairs from the hotel the next morning. Saying goodbye to this dear land of ours and maybe never to return or to see our loved ones again was a sobering thought. But this is what we had joined the Army Nurse Corps for and certainly didn't want to back out now. When they, in New York, they were issued necessary identification papers. And this is what a War Department ID looked like. I want you to know something. First, this was for Elizabeth Sandelius, a true daughter of Montana. She was born in Coketail on the other side of Bozeman Pass. She joined the Army Nurse Corps after being the superintendent of the Columbus, Montana Hospital. Notice something here, right there. This is the first time in American history that women were fingerprinted, that's your fingerprint of your right index finger, for purposes other than incarceration in a prison. The women were required to wear a Red Cross brassard on their arm and to carry this ID. If they were captured by the Germans and they could show that they were Red Cross and here's my identification, that kept them from getting accused of being a spy and shot. That happened to an English nurse, Edith Clavel. The Germans caught her. She said that she was a nurse. She couldn't prove it. The Germans lined her up and shot her. The nurses were given dog tags, and I was privileged to hold Sandy Sandelius' dog tag in my hand as I photographed that, thinking that that's what she carried all through the war. The number on that, the AEF stands for American Expeditionary Force, the number on that was her Red Cross registration number. But she carried that, and I held it in my hand, and I was very honored to do that. The women sailed on passenger ships. They didn't sail on military ships because a battleship is not designed to carry hundreds of people. The most dangerous part of their journey was right there, at that dog leg. Why do you think that? U-boats. The Germans hung out there at the entrance to St. George's Channel, and that's where they sank the majority of the ships. Going across, the German U-boats did attack these boats, and Lucy Walters, the indomitable nurse from Glasgow, almost went overboard when the ship went hard over on the helm, and she almost slipped overboard and went into the water. One of the ships that American nurses and five Montana nurses went overseas was the SS Minnesotanabe. On its return trip, after it had taken 150 nurses, including five nurses from Montana, on its return trip back to America in September 19, it was torpedoed off the Irish coast and went to the bottom, and 40 of its crew were killed. When the women arrived in England and France, they were sent to where the need was greatest. And that could be anywhere from the front lines to establish hospitals back in Paris. There's about 10,000 nurses that ultimately went to France. That was about half the number that the army needed. When the army went to France, it began using the French telephone system. The problem there was the operators didn't speak English, and a lot of GIs didn't speak French. So the General Pershing sent an order back to America that he wanted bilingual telephone operators to get over to France immediately. He wanted 500 of them, and over 7,500 of them applied nationwide. And at that time, there was also a nationwide telephone strike in 1917, which came all the way to Montana. And the telephone operators in Missoula did a job action one day to protest wages and benefits, and they transferred all the telephone calls to the women's dorm at the University of Montana. The civilian operators were getting about $30 a month. The Army said, we'll pay you $125 a month. That's why all these women stampeded to get in to the women's telephone unit of the American Signal Corps. Colloquially, they were called the Hello Girls. As you see in this photograph from the National Archives, they look like they're in Army uniforms. They look like they're wearing rank, and they certainly were doing their job. Unfortunately, the Army didn't think that way. The Army said, you weren't in the Army, you were civilian contractors. And for the next 60 years, a Montana woman, Merle Egan Anderson from Helena, led a 60-year effort to get veteran status for these women of the American Signal Corps. Legislation was signed in 1978 to finally recognize them as military veterans and get military status and recognition. Legislation has been submitted in Congress to award the Hello Girls of World War I the Congressional Gold Medal. One of the sponsors was Senator Tester from Montana, and I am honored to be on the research effort for those women, and hopefully they'll receive that gold medal soon. As I said, when the women arrived in France, they were sent where the need was greatest. Some of them, like Alice Ralston, went immediately to the front battle line. Her hospital, Base Hospital 10, was about 20 to 30 miles off the main combat at a place called Ypres. If you know anything about World War I, the battles of Ypres were savage and terrible. Many of them went to the field hospitals, as shown here, which were nothing more than a collection of tents, something similar to the old television series MASH. Pretty much the same thing. However, they did not paint a red cross on the tents. They painted a white cross because when the Germans were flying over the tents, the red mixed in with the green, and they couldn't identify, they couldn't see them as a hospital. So they painted white on the tents. The war was savage, and the American Red Cross War Journal reads, base hospitals have been stripped of every available officer and nurse for the purpose of forming surgical teams supporting the troops. The situation was saved only by the self-sacrificing spirit of the officers, nurses, and men. It was not at all uncommon for nurses to work 14 to 18 hours a day for weeks at a time. In March of 1918, when the German advance threatened to cut off Base Hospital 10, where Alice Ralston was, the chief nurse, Margaret Dunlop, wrote of the evacuation. This meant the evacuation of over 10,000 wounded men in 2 to 3 days, as many of the patients had but small chance of living under the best of conditions. It seemed a heartbreaking thing to do, to move these men. An order came at 10 one morning that 45 nurses should be ready, bedding and baggage, in 2 hours to get the men out of the area. But they got it done. In August of 1918, Field Hospital 112 was a collection of tents near Caen, France. Elizabeth Sandy Sandelius was sent there. She volunteered to go. And the field hospital began being shelled and bombed by the Germans. They were in terrible need of nurses. The word went back to the Navy, send a naval team from Brest, France, to help the Army nurses on the front line. One of the naval nurses was Mary Elderkins. She was not from Montana. And she wrote, "The days were intensely hot and the nights bitterly cold. The flies were unbearable. We had air raids night after night. When we were not operating at night, we spent the time from darkness to dawn in a cellar, 20 feet underground. It just held 7 cots, and 13 nurses were supposed to sleep there. If we sat erect on the cot, our heads struck the rough stone above. Water dripped on us all night long. Huge black bugs crawled about, and after we quieted down, we could hear the rats. We felt like rats in some trap, for in the case of a direct hit, our chances of getting out were slim. On the morning of August 10th, the Germans had found our range. They opened fire on us, or rather on their objective about us. With shells falling all about us, we went back that night 3 miles. The Navy nurses backed up 3 miles. Elizabeth Sandelius refused to abandon her post. She stayed there under fire for 8 consecutive days and was cited for gallantry in action. The citation reads, "For 8 consecutive days in August of 1918, Elizabeth Sandelius was on duty with Field Hospital Company 112 operating north of Caen, France. Notwithstanding nightly air raids upon the town, harassing shell fire during the daytime, she repeatedly refused to retire to the rear and continued to administer to the needs of the wounded, exhibiting at all times a splendid spirit of self-sacrifice, courage, and devotion to duty, which largely contributed to the welfare and rapid convalescence of the wounded officers and soldiers entrusted to her care." For her heroism under fire, I submitted her formally for the Army Silver Star Medal last year. If this is approved, she'll be only the 4th female in United States military history of World War I to receive the Silver Star Medal. After the war, by the way, Sandy Sandelius hid a deep secret from the Army. You see, 2 weeks before she went to war, she married her love. They thought they could go to war together. They didn't. He was sent to aviation school in California. She went to war in France. And she never told anybody she was a married woman. She came back to Montana. They lived a good life, raised a family. They moved to California. And Elizabeth Sandelius died of old age in L.A., and she's one of only 18 Montana women veterans of World War I buried in a United States National Cemetery. She's buried in Los Angeles National Cemetery in L.A. Another remarkable story is Harriet Marie O'Day from Billings. She was sent to Evacuation Hospital Number 4, about 2 miles west of the hellhole called Verdun. Just days before the armistice was signed, the Germans shelled Evac 4. The chief nurse at Evac 4 that day was Cassie White. Cassie White was from New York State, but Cassie gave the order to evacuate the American wounded. Every nurse there picked up a litter, put a wounded man on there, and carried the wounded men to safety, including Harriet, while the artillery rounds came in. Cassie White was blown flat by an artillery explosion, but she got up and kept on going. These women were also cited for heroism under fire. Harriet O'Day survived the war. She came back to Billings, married late in life, had no children. And she and her husband lived a long and happy life. They are buried side by side in the Laurel City Cemetery within walking distance of my wife's and my house. Where were these people? Sometimes I need to put a map to show everybody. Right there is Paris. Right up here is Brussels, Belgium. The battle line was right between them. Alice Ralston was up here at Base Hospital 10 in a very precarious tactical position. Elizabeth Sandelis was right here in the center of everything, along with some other Montana nurses, by the way. Harriet O'Day was right here on the Allied right flank near Verdun. The battle raged up and down this line, and Montana's women served proud during that fight. Cora Viola Craig wanted to be a medical missionary, a quiet, kind of plain-looking woman from Glasgow. She homesteaded north of Glasgow, never married, no children. Her nearest neighbor was 15 miles away, but she did just fine. She wanted to be a missionary to a foreign country and to a foreign people. When the war came, she went overseas, and she found out that the Kingdom of Siam actually sent soldiers to help the Americans or the Allied effort, and she volunteered to tend to the wounded soldiers of the King of Siam. For her service, he awarded her an engraved silver medal. She never married, had no children, and later in life moved to Kansas City to be near her sister, where she died in the 60s, I believe. The whereabouts of her silver medal from the King of Siam is unknown. As I said, the nurses or any other female serving in the military at that time in America had to be white and not German. The black nurses came on their own. Their story is unheralded, and America owes them a deep debt of gratitude to helping the black soldiers who were sick and wounded. However, there were 13 American Indian nurses also serving in World War I. My research shows a 14th. I didn't think that someone named McIntyre Early would be a member of an American Indian tribe, but she was. Her mother was Confederated Salish Kootenai from up around the Kalispell area. When I found that out, I researched Regina McIntyre Early, and I sent my research to the Salish Kootenai, and I said, "What say ye about this?" And less than a half a day later, they sent me an email saying, "Yes, she is on our rolls." So the first Native American female veteran of World War I from Montana has been shown and proven, and her name is Regina McIntyre Early. Last year, my wife and I were invited to Pablo, Montana, where her name is shown here, was engraved on the Salish Kootenai's English Circle, or Eagle Circle Wall of Remembrance. And we were very honored to be there. And my wife and I were singled out for our efforts to show that Regina McIntyre Early was indeed an American Indian nurse from Montana. The other great sadness is the men died too. When Susie Wellborn McCrum, who grew up around Belgrade, went to war, so did her brother. Also, when Eula Butzerin from Missoula went to war, so did her brother. The women soon found that their brothers were killed in action. Susie Wellborn McCrum was a remarkable Montana woman, nurse all over the state, tough gal, became a nurse in Miles City. When she learned her brother was killed in action, she went on a journey to find him, as did Eula. The story of Eula Butzrin trying to find her killed in action brother could fill volumes. I tried finding out what she did, but it was pretty tough because women were not allowed to keep journals, diaries. Their letters were censored, and they could not take cameras for photographs. After the war, Eula went on a quest to find her brother's grave. She crossed the battlefields of Europe, and with the help of a guide, she found his grave marked by a stick with his dog tags on it. Both Frank Wellborn and Roy Butzrin still lie in the fields of France where they gave their lives. After the war, the nurses started coming home. They didn't come home as units. They came home individually, maybe groups of two or three. They came back with a lot that we would call PTSD now. In fact, two nurses who were sisters, not from Montana, on a return trip on a ship, for whatever reason known to them, wrote a note, left it on their bunks, went on board deck, linked arms, and jumped off the boat to their deaths. When the women came back, Marcia Lang from Havre left a note that sticks with me today, that the women carried a lot of what they saw, and they never wrote about it, or very little was wrote about it. But they've started a long fight for recognition. And when they came back, Montana's women veterans of World War I returned and reentered life as best they could. Their war travels and service in America and overseas gave them a perspective few had, and then now. As nurses with experience and professional credentials, they could relocate if they wanted. Many of these women moved from Montana and didn't return. Montana women who served in World War I didn't leave many written accounts of their time in war and their experiences and friendships they left behind. Virginia Flanagan wrote briefly of events she saw, but what Flanagan didn't write is how to say goodbye to friends you bonded with under fire and in hardships of war. Friends who shared adversities and privations never thought possible. Friends you shared more than day talk, but shared life, sorrows, hopes, and innermost fears. Friends unlike you never had before or thought you would have. They held your soul. You gave them a lasting hug, a hearty handshake, held back tears, and set your quivering jaw and nodded a goodbye. You promised you would write, but in time you found the memories lost or too painful. You moved on, and so did they. When sunset quieted the day and people settled into their reflections, you remember the long ago and the people you walked with. You looked to the sunset and thought, it was good. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you for your attention. That concludes my presentation. I have published a book on these women because it was the right thing to do. We have a saying in the Army that we don't leave anybody behind in body, in memory, or in spirit. We can't bring their body home, we'll bring their memory home. And we'll make darn sure that nobody ever forgets them. If there's one thing that I can say about my book, it's not the gratitude that I found in the 8-year effort to publish that book, to write it, but my charge to ensure these women are not forgotten. If there's one thing I can proudly say is, I tried. They're not forgotten. Thank you. I will take any questions you might have. The question is, were the soldiers allowed to keep journals, take photographs? And the answer is no. The reason is for operational security. By the way, in World War II, even my father was not allowed to keep journals and whatnot. The only journal available that I know of was a Bible where somebody had written in the margins of the Bible. Nobody's going to take your Bible. So they wrote their notes in the margin of the Bible. They were not allowed to keep journals. Their letters were censored, and they were not allowed to take cameras for photographs. What few letters exist were written after the war ended. The question is, were the women compensated for their going to nursing school? Not if they were not members of the student nurse corps, then they were not compensated from the federal government. They went just like you paid the tuition and you went. But when the student nurse corps came in, the military said, we will pay your way, books and tuition, fees. And once you graduate, then you agree to serve in the armed forces for at least 3 years. And as I said, Montana had one of the highest highest rates of enrollment in America. Montana always fulfilled its quota for the student nurse corps. The question is, did the nurses of World War I receive full recognition, benefits? The answer is no. They struggled for... The women in the Army Nurse Corps and the Navy Nurse Corps did not receive equal pay, equal benefits, and equal recognition and equal status until legislation was passed in 1947 and 1948, which gave them full recognition as officers in the armed forces of the United States. Even in World War II, the women did not have the same pay and benefits and recognition and status as the men. The question is, why were the Hello Girls paid more than the nurses? You could get $125 a month as a telephone operator in the Signal Corps if you were a chief operator. The entry-level pay, around $40 or $50 a month entry, but as you progressed up, you could receive $125 a month. The nurses received about $50 or $60 a month, and if they went overseas to face gunfire, they got $10 extra a month for hazardous duty pay. That's about what I got, too, by the way, in the Gulf War. But the question is, when Marsha Lang from Havre came back, she noted that she knew of 17 women who came back to Montana. We would call it PTSD, post-traumatic stress disorder. I tried looking into that, but very little is written about the mental status of the women. In fact, one of the Red Cross journals reads, their countenance resembled that of the forlorn countenance of a homeless cat, meaning they just came back and they didn't come back to parades. When Virginia Flanagan came back to New York, she was given a train ticket home, and she just went home. No parades, no welcome home ceremonies, no bands, nothing like that. They just went home. As sad as that sounds, that's what happened to them.